Before the Go-Go's became a pop sensation with their 1981 debut album, Beauty and the Beat, they were known in the LA punk scene as one of the wildest girl groups.
In the upcoming book, More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of LA Punk, and the documentary On the Go-Go's for Showtime, punk rock writer Pleasant Gaiman gives her take on why the LA punk scene was such a fertile ground to nurture talent.
Today, Princess of Hollywood, the divination Princess Farhana, Pleasant Gaiman, joins us to give us a glimpse into her wild, wild life living in the punk scene of the 80s and her witch-themed occult burlesque show.
Listen as Pleasant talks about taking Kurt Cobain to drag shows, stalking horror hostess Vampira, and why she wants to ride the Goodyear blimp with her hashtag, Blimpin' Ain't Easy.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people like you. Thank you. Right now, we need your help. After many years of creating podcasts and videos you love, our dear computer can't take it anymore and is ready to go to the great big recycling bin in the sky. It is heartbreaking to be in this situation.
Visit GoFundMe.com/Feast of Fun Computer right now and give any amount. Help us reach our goal of saving the show's podcasting computer. Every dollar you give goes directly into making Feast of Fun last for years to come. We know we can count on you to make a big difference and continue the show. Thank you for loving Feast of Fun.
Thank you very much. Once again, the link is GoFundMe.com/Feast of Fun Computer.
Hi, love. How are you doing, Pleasant?
Hi, Pleasant. I'm here too.
Hey, y'all.
It's been a while.
I know. Like when I found out how long it was since the last time, I was kind of shocked.
It's been at least a year, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, I think it was in 2017.
No, it couldn't have been that long. Wow.
That's what Jeff said.
All right, I believe Jeff. Jeff is an honorable man. He would not lie to us. A shout out to Jeff Knutson, who helps us with Cooking with Drag Queens and has been a listener of the podcast for years. He's the one who introduced us to you, and we've been delighted to get to know you over the years.
Likewise.
Where are you right now? Are you in your living room? Are you near?
I'm in my living room in the shadow of the Hollywood sign.
Oh, don't jump off it. You know, a lot of people are very attracted to that sign, like moths to a flame.
Oh, you don't have to tell me about that. I live in this neighborhood. Sometimes you have to show your ID just to, like in the summer, because there's so many tourists.
Oh, wow.
Well, and it's kind of hard to find the right spot to get your picture taken. They're like, you have to go here, you have to go here. And it's kind of like, it's hard.
I know where that secret spot is.
And you're not telling anyone.
Nope.
Congratulations on the Go-Go's documentary being made.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not congratulations to me. It's congratulations to them. But I can't wait to see it. My interview for that was so much fun.
Well, that, it was great that they were able to work with you and get you to tell the story, the dirt, the juice. Oh,
I think there's all sorts of dirt and juice going into that because they talked to like pretty much everybody. That whole crew was great. There was a bunch of wonderful women, and my interview particularly, we were laughing hysterically.
For people who may not be familiar, you were gal pals with Belinda Carlisle and many members of the Go-Go's in the early days when they were seen mostly as a punk all-girl group in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, and even later than that, like Belinda and I were roommates, and she had to move out after when Our Lips Are Sealed went to number one, because our house was turning into a scene from It's a Hard Day's Night.
That's the punk palace you lived in.
Yeah, that was Disgraceland. But yeah. I mean, I'm not kidding. It was like we lived between two elementary schools, which was hell with our 80s style hangovers. You know, I mean, that was just like the universe paying us back for all the hell and havoc we were wreaking. But
so you're up all night partying, you're not even in bed yet, and then all these school kids are going to next to you.
But also with their arms through the mail slots and like their faces pressed up against the window.
Were the kids familiar with the Go-Go's after they had seen them on the television?
Because it was number one. And the best story from that time period is that there was, we had these neighbors upstairs that had a teenage daughter, and she used to go on binges of playing records. Yes, I said records. She'd play records. She'd play records over and over with the arm across the turntable, so the record would just repeat. And for a while, she was on this binge of "I Feel Love" by Donna Summer. Like, I mean, we're talking about hours in a row. And then one day, it changed to "Our Lips Are Sealed." And at about like the 3 or 4 hour point, Belinda was laying on her bed, writhing around and crying with a pillow over her head. And like, she was like, just make it stop. And I don't think she even understood the irony that I was clearly seeing, which was that the girl upstairs would have no idea that, like, this number one pop hit that she was hearing, you know, the person that sang it was living downstairs, because our building was just a damn slum. I mean, it was like in a really bad neighborhood. The whole building was infested with roaches. It had been built in the 20s and never, you know, never like renovated or anything. And so my other roommate, Anne McLean, like, we were all just like standing around in Belinda's bedroom while she was having a nervous breakdown. And finally, Anne said really helpfully, maybe you should put a towel around your head and put some cold cream on and go up and tell them to stop it.
So how did you get together with Belinda Carlisle in the first place to become roommates?
You know, I don't remember exactly how we met. We were just seeing each other all over town, you know.
Were you guys dating each other, or was it just a friendship?
This is so relevant to the Oscars right now. Belinda and I met in the lobby of the Beverly Hilton. I was with the guys that would later become the punk band The Germs, the really well-known punk band. Mm-hmm. And Pat Smear went on to be in Nirvana and Foo Fighters and stuff. So he was my boyfriend at the time. And Belinda was there with Lorna Doom, who also went on to be in The Germs, their bass player. And sadly, she just passed on like a few weeks ago. But we were all in the Beverly Hilton lobby, lurking around waiting for Queen, who was staying there, because we were all obsessed with Queen.
Freddie Mercury and the Bohemian Rhapsody band.
That's what I mean. It's apropos. So it's kind of Queen's fault that Belinda and I met.
Aww. So you were waiting for Queen to come on, or you guys were like groupies?
No, we were
for
in
Queen?
The lobby of the hotel, all being groupies, like stalking them. Now you'd call it stalking or loitering. We were definitely loitering. We were all cutting school to loiter.
Did you guys get to meet Freddie Mercury or any of the band members?
I never met Freddie Mercury, but I met some of the other band members later. But not at that time. But also at that time, I was working at a uniform store after school. And I stole one of the Beverly Hilton maid uniforms. So I hadn't done it at that point, but later on that made it really convenient to go in and lurk around when other rock stars were staying there, because they all stayed there.
Oh my God, you have had like a career of stalking people in some senses, huh?
Yes, stalking, stealing, I was a teenage juvenile delinquent. That should be the name of my next book. But I think everyone already knows it from my Instagram, which, by the way, is at Princess of Hollywood.
Were you into music journalism and you know, booking acts and stuff like that because of your passion in music, or which came first? Because you're very successful at booking people. You gave Hole, Courtney Love's band's, their first gig in Los Angeles.
Yes. I'd been into rock and roll since I was like 11 or 12, and I read all the rock and roll magazines. And even one of my babysitters, who was an amazing drag queen, sat me down one day when I was 13 and said, "This is Andy Warhol's interview," and made me read it. And I thought it was the best thing I'd ever seen in my life. So I was really into anything that was rock and roll, glitter, drag, theater, all that kind of stuff. And when I was about 16, I'd be reading you know, reviews of different bands or concerts or records in all the mainstream rock and roll magazines. And I would just look at it and go, wow, this person just got it all wrong. That's not what that record's about. But also at the same time, I was cutting my high school typing class because I thought it was stupid and boring, you know? But so I thought, like this light bulb came on in my head, and I realized that if I wrote about rock and roll, I could get into shows for free or get free records. So I just sat down with, you know, some records and a couple of shows I'd seen like lately, you know, and I just wrote longhand reviews of them. And the reviews took me like about 20 or 30 minutes to write. But then I stayed up all night on a manual typewriter doing hunt and peck typing so I could get them all typed up. And I sent them off to some newspapers and magazines through snail mail. And then they all got accepted. And then one of the editors at one of the papers called me back and said, we'd like you to do more. Do you have more? And I said, yeah. And I figured at that point that I had a foot in the door. So the next reviews I wrote on my lined high school three-hole notebook paper, and I wrote it in ballpoint pen, and I sent it in. And then the editor called me up and said, do you think you can type this up? And I just said, my typewriter's in the shop. And
you actually took Kurt Cobain to some of his first drag shows in Los Angeles.
Well, I don't know if it was his first drag show ever, but it was definitely his first LA drag show. It was at the Silver Lake Lounge, and they used to have amazing drag shows there. Run by this awesome queen called Alexis Caramello, the male actress, and she was.
That sounds familiar.
She was fantastic. She was pretty old at the time, and she was probably less than 5 feet tall and really round. But like her eyelashes were, you know, like elbow length, and she had giant bouffants, and she was an amazing dancer. And later on, we became friends, but I took Kurt there when we were in the middle of doing an interview for Rip magazine. And he was wearing like a pajama shirt, and like most people at that place didn't know who he was, but then some did. So that was kind of crazy, because really, what would Kurt Cobain be doing at a Hispanic drag club in Silver Lake?
This is after sort of the Nirvana had hit it big.
Oh yeah, they were huge at that point. I mean, this was like in the middle of their heyday.
And so what was usually like Kurt Cobain's interest in the drag shows? Was it just because he had a passion for performance or the anarchy of it? Or
I don't even know. I just thought he would like it. I used to bring everyone to drag shows. I brought like one of the most famous belly dancers in Egypt to a drag show at the Plaza. And then I just thought people needed to see drag, you know, and this was decades before RuPaul's Drag Race or anything, but it, like the drag shows in LA at that time were just exquisite. They were amazing full productions, you know, old school drag and a lot of like boundary pushing, weird, crazy drag, but not the Tranimal stuff that developed, you know, later. You know, Tranimal is just like that postmodern crazy, you know, like kind of like the Cockettes in San Francisco in the 60s, but brought to a warp level. It's like someone in like full drag, but kind of messy and crazy, maybe like full drag with like a handlebar mustache or just, you know, like weird netting covering your face or just like hot mess awesomeness, you know, that kind of thing. Mm.
And so a lot of these musicians and entertainers that, you know, they may have been familiar with drag or whatever, but you're sort of putting them in the front row seat with some of the best talent in Los Angeles. I can imagine that you had a really profound influence on their ability to embrace LGBT people.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, probably. But I mean, also, you like for Kurt, you got to remember, I mean, this might have been a subconscious reason of mine. You remember there was like pictures of him in a dress and stuff like that, or he'd play like that. And I don't know. I always myself had an obsession with makeup and drag, probably thanks to my babysitter who was gay and who actually has an amazing like online magazine of like, you know, old movies. And he's an incredible movie critic and lover. His name is Gary Morris and his website is Bright Lights.
Nice.
So he'd been my babysitter when I was 9 to like about 12. And he was the one that introduced me to Andy Warhol's interview. He had a giant influence on my life. And we're actually still in touch with each other on Facebook.
Pleasant, it seems like you're moving the phone a lot, or it keeps on whacking something.
No, I'm just, if I shift position even an inch, this is like the weird Wi-Fi in my house. This is what I was telling you about pre-show.
Well, I think we can muddle through it, can we, Mark?
Here, how about this? Wait, something's wrong with the Wi-Fi.
Well, it just sounds like the phone's whacking your jewelry on your face or something.
No, I'm not. No, the phone is sitting on a table. My house is haunted.
Are you using a speakerphone?
Yeah. I have to, because if I move, because
you're so dynamic.
Yeah.
You can't sit still.
No, but I mean, if I moved, seriously, if I had the phone up to my head, if I moved even a half an inch, it would fully cut out. I'm not
That's
kidding.
That's fine. So, you know, in terms of like, you know, your passion for, let's just describe this as eclectic, right? Sensibilities and music and culture. One of the things people that you stalked famously was Vampira, who is the precursor. She was a horror hostess and a precursor to Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Yeah, I didn't even stalk her. I mean, here's the thing that was crazy about that whole scenario was there used to be a coffee shop called like Angel's Coffee Shop on Hollywood Boulevard, and now it's like part of this big hipster hotel. But in those days, like in the 80s, it was just you know, like a slummy old 50s motel. And I used to just go there and have coffee, and I was always talking to this really beautiful older lady. And in my neighborhood in those times, you know, because I live in Central Hollywood, there was a lot of ladies that looked that you'd see them on the bus, and they'd be wearing like full gloves and like a hat with a veil. They would just be dressed like 50s starlets, but they were in their 60s or 70s at the time. Mm. And so she was always at the coffee shop, and I used to talk to her, and we'd talk about animals. You know, like she did what's now called dog rescue. You know, like, but I mean, she didn't have an organization or anything. And so we would talk about that. And then one day, from Tomato of the band The Screamers, and Tomato was also openly gay and had been in the Cockettes in San Francisco, Tomato told me that Vampira went there, and I kind of didn't believe him. And then one day when I was talking to this woman, I asked her what her name was, and she said Myla. And all of a sudden it clicked into my head, and I was like, Myla Nurmi, which was Vampira's real name. And she said, yes. And then I was, you know, I was having a head explosion at the time that I was really valiantly trying to hide, because I couldn't believe I'd been talking to her for months and it was Vampira. So
she was just like, it didn't strike you as a horror hostess or this kind of eclectic person.
No, she looked like, I mean, she didn't look like that all the time, just like Cassandra Peterson doesn't look like that all the time. But she was gorgeous. You could tell she had been some kind of a starlet. I mean, she had like, her cheekbones were high enough to like, you know, do ski jumps off of. And she had big blue eyes and, you know, but she was wearing like, you know, a sweatshirt and pants or something,
I do notice this with a lot of drag queens this day and age. And this kind of draws back to RuPaul's statement about shaving your eyebrows. RuPaul famously says in a lot of interviews that by shaving his eyebrows, it made it faster for him to dress up in drag, and it made him more committed to being a successful drag queen. And he likes to impress upon him on his girls, this contestants on the show and other and the public. And so what I'm starting to notice is that a lot of entertainers, instead of having seen their work clothes, their stage character be very different from themselves, we're starting to see more of an integration where their offstage persona resembles their offstage presence starts to mirror more what they look like on stage until the two finally become one.
I agree with that. And I'll tell you a funny eyebrow story. One time I was on a plane to Australia because I was, you know, doing a bunch of performances and teaching dance classes down there. And I was the only person on the plane that was awake because that's like a 17-hour flight. And I was like doing yoga and splits in the aisle, stretching. And I wandered into the bathroom, you know, where it's in a plane bathroom. It's like fluorescent lights, horror. And I looked at myself in the mirror and I was horrified because I didn't have any eyebrows on, you know, because my eyebrows are shaved and plucked all the time. And I was like, oh my God, I look terrifying. You know, this is like hour 13 or something. And then I thought, oh, well, it's not that bad because my eyebrows look like this because in real life, you know, I can look great. And then all of a sudden I went down this like rabbit hole of philosophy and I was like, oh my God, do I think walking around is fake life and being on stage is real life?
Ah,
that's very profound. I really like that.
Yeah.
Why would the stage be in front of a performance? Because the word, you know, drag, was a lot of people attribute to Shakespeare and all the stuff. Mark did Uncovered was actually a euphemism for staging. In the past, they would stage fox hunts by dragging a fox's corpse around the countryside. And so the dogs and the horses had a scent to follow. And that the term dragging, in terms of using it to stage something, then got used in car automobile races, a drag race.
Drag race, yeah. Mm.
And, you know, actors started talking about my drag, it being something, you know, referencing the drag race and a drag hunt as something that these frocks that you slapped on your body to create the illusion of being somebody else. And so, you know, when RuPaul talks about you're born naked and the rest is drag, actually, that's the most original meaning of the word drag, which is to stage something, mm-hmm. to create an illusion that's not really there. And so for what I think is interesting with talking to you is that for you, the stage is such a authentic place to be yourself that the power to transform yourself allows you to become the person you were really meant to be.
I agree with that totally. And I've always called what I do drag, even before Drag Race became a thing. I mean, for decades, I call it drag. And I used to always say I was a drag queen trapped in a woman's body, and then that got amended to a bio woman's body, you know.
Well, that's why Alexandra Billings says she's a famous trans actress known for her appearances on
Transparent,
but also she was one of the first trans people to play a trans character on television. And I think it was CSI, was it? I think it was the show. And she said the part of the reason that trans people spark such strong feelings, negative feelings in people is because they see somebody fulfilling their fantasies, their lives, they're living as their authentic selves. And that can be too much for some people.
I think that might be true. I mean, I feel like a lot of people, you know, obviously I'm not trans, but I am transformational all the time. I think a lot of people resent me or don't like me for that same reason, you know, because I've always done exactly what I wanted to do or looked exactly like I wanted to look or any of that, you know, like.
Well, it's tricky, right? It's like some of us, you know, have to go to our job and, you know, deal with difficult people. And it's like, and then we turn on the TV set and we see, you know, somebody on a reality TV show just talking about how they like to put on makeup and have sex and drink and get drunk. And we're like, why isn't my life like, you know, the Real Housewives of so-and-so?
That was what my life was like a lot.
Well, I mean, was it because you were like married to somebody who was able to like afford that kind of lifestyle, or were you just kind of like living frugally?
I haven't had a normal job since the 80s. Honestly, I've only done, you know, whatever I do, like writing, dancing, tarot reading, putting on shows. I mean, it's not like a, you know, it's not a rich or opulent lifestyle by any means, but you know, like it just enables me to do a lot of stuff like that all the time. I've been doing that. And I remember I used to, there's like, I've had different boyfriends over different times that I thought would be like just right to look like, you know, a woman. And I liked putting makeup on guys, but I would draw the line like that had to be a certain type of guy. And it wasn't even necessarily a sexual thing, although I did get turned on by it, but it was more aesthetics. Like I wouldn't put like a, you know, a really butch guy, man's man guy in makeup. But if I saw someone who had like great lines in their face, you know, like a beautiful face or a fantastic bone structure, I would be like, let me put makeup on you. And most of the time they would agree. And sometimes they wouldn't be into it. But then after a few drinks, it started. And then after makeup came like evening gowns or slutty lingerie. And, you know, and then came photos on like those cardboard disposable cameras.
Boudoir photography.
Totally. Oh
Let's
my God.
Get erotic.
I'm going to tell you a really good story. I live in the Hollywood Hills, you know, thanks a shitty Wi-Fi, but also, this is a really transient neighborhood I live in. And by transient, I don't mean homeless, although there's starting to be so many homeless people in Hollywood, but I mean, there's people always coming into my neighborhood for pilots, you know, for pilot season, or moving here to work on a movie, doing makeup, or you know, come into LA to do styling. And this was even before Airbnb, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there was always just people moving in and out. So garbage day in my neighborhood is just magnificent. I mean, you find the best stuff all the time on the street. And also my, you know, there's also a lot of clubs around here, and people always go up my street or the surrounding streets to like park and have sex. So there's always like weird stuff, like, you know, a pair of underpants and a six pack, like laying in the gutter or something. But so one day we found this whole treasure trove of someone's eviction, and the person had obviously been either I'm saying this because of the 80s and early 90s look of, you know, what was in their trash. This person had obviously either been a quote, quote, female impersonator, or was really into drag or living a trans lifestyle, because there was all these magazines from the 80s and the 90s, like those like, you know, typeset, almost Xerox, but really cheaply printed, like magazines about female impersonation. Mm. And there was also all these like slutty, like neon bathing suits and lots of lingerie. And there was like a giant, huge tub full of shoes, like awesome hooker heels, like with lucite soles and rhinestones and a million buckles and stuff like that. But they were like size 13 or 14. I was trying to give them away to friends of mine that did drag, but they were way too big for almost anyone's feet. So this was right around the 4th of July, and some neighbors had dug out a horseshoe pit in their front yard, and they were going to have a barbecue and play horseshoes. So I came over there with this box, and I was like, no, instead of playing horseshoes, let's play hoe shoes. And so we made up a whole scoring thing, like you got more points if only the heel went around the stake or if it landed.
Oh, I wish I had been there for the party.
Yeah, it was a good party.
Who won?
I don't remember. We were so drunk. I can't remember who won, but I'll just claim it. No.
So how do those neon bikinis fit you?
They were all too big for me. This was like a big person. Mm. But I'm not above like I mean, you can take the girl out of punk rock, but you can't take the punk rock out of the girl. I found this really awesome cashmere cowl necked vintage sweater the other day in the garbage, like walking up the street, and it's been raining a lot in LA. Like, we're out of a drought and into, like, you know, just insane precipitation. So this was between rainstorms. And I think that these clothes were from a girl, but they were like draped over the side of a trash can on the first sunny day in like 2 weeks. And I saw this glittering copper colored 70s Lurex, and then I saw a sleeve. And so I gingerly pulled them out with my hand. And it was a full length evening gown with rhinestone straps. And then there was this amazing like cashmere sweater. So I brought them home and I threw them in my bathtub and I washed them a million times and they still stunk of mildew. So I left them out in the sun for like 3 days straight and pulled them in right before it started raining again. And I haven't been able to take that sweater off in a week. It's so good. It's so Audrey Hepburn.
And so the life that you live, I imagine, it seems very fun and outlandish and colorful for people who weren't there. But, you know, for the Go-Go's, for the L.A. punk scene of the 1980s, this was business as usual.
It was totally business as usual. Like, people always wonder, like, you know, what the 80s was like. And the first thing I have to remind them is there was no social media. There was no Wi-Fi. There wasn't even call waiting for a while. It was all landlines. Almost nobody we knew had cars, you know, because either we were too young or we couldn't afford them. You know, I mean, it was such a different time. You would go out to clubs and everyone you knew would be there. And in hindsight, I look at that and I was like, how is this even possible? Like, how did we all know? Is it, you know, it was like smoke signal radar love, kind of crazy.
Well, somebody was pointing out that the average income of people who went to discotheques was significantly higher in the 70s and 80s. And so it allowed people to work a 9-to-5 job, even like 3 days a week, and spend the long weekend on drugs and dancing and drinking at clubs all the time. And so the idea for us, like, if you go out to a nightclub in this day and age, you're looking at least $100 in terms of, you know, and we're not even talking about the costumes you're going to wear just to go out and have fun. And that seems like something that people do on an occasion, not on a regular basis. And part of it is just that the average income of a, you know, middle class person has stayed has frozen in the last 30 years.
Yeah, when you're young, you just have more disposable income because you don't have the kids, you don't have the car payments, you might be working a shitty job, but you got $20 in your pocket, you can go out all night.
But it's not necessarily that.
Yeah, and you've got the energy to do it, too. Yeah.
Like, if you talk to any economist in the last 30 years, all these individuals, the reason, like, you look at the middle class in Chicago, for example, just the ability to, like, have this really playful lifestyle is very compromised. And in terms of, you know, like, social media, you know, we're spending more time sort of interacting in a place where we can't see what our words and actions impact on somebody else has. And so some people, like, I've talked to you about this, is that there was a lot of goodwill at that time period that isn't there today. Everybody's sort of like trying to fight to get a career on some reality TV show, or trying to, you know, get people to follow them on Instagram. And there's not a lot of, there's not as much passion about forming a community and forming long-term bonds with people.
I agree with that, but I totally agree with that. But also, a lot of the people that I met during those days, like the late 70s through the late 80s, you know, they're lifelong friends. And it's not even only that. I think we were all at an age where you make those connections. And also, most of us had been outcasts in our younger life, you know, like, we were either what would now be called bullied in school, you know, because we were different, or you know, different or gay or looked weird or whatever, you know. So I mean, when we connected with each other then and found out that we all had the same frame of reference, we'd all seen like mostly the same movies, had read the same books, liked the same records. I mean, that was like a revelation, because most of us were in environments where no one was doing what we were doing. And when we all came together in that punk scene, it was unbelievable. It was connecting with your tribe in a way that, like, none of us had experienced, you know, so that was pretty profound.
So there's a sequel to the bestseller Under the Big Black Sun called More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of LA Punk by John Doe and Tom DeSavio that's coming out this summer in June. And in this book, it really gives us a never before in-depth look at what the LA punk scene was like and why it generated all this amazing music, but also how unique it was in terms of culture and youth culture in the world.
Yes. I mean, that first book, which, you know, like John and Tom assigned chapters to a bunch of people that were around back then. And mine was one of them. Jane Weedland from the Go-Go's had one. I mean, there was a bunch of chapters written by people that were either in well-known bands or that were very instrumental in the punk scene. And this second one is exactly the same. It's not all the same people, but some people have repeat chapters. Like, I mean, they got asked to do chapters again, like Jane did one and I did one. So this one looks at that LA punk scene in the 80s as it was morphing into something else. And I just got to tell you that my chapter in the new one makes my chapter, which was pretty racy in the first one, look like kindergarten.
Because wow.
No, I know. Like when I was talking to John and Tom, they said, you know, like, do you want to write about hardcore punk? And I was like, no, you know, I don't like hardcore punk. And they said, well, what do you want to write about? And I said, I want to write about Disgraceland and other stuff that I was doing. And they said, well, like, what are some of the stories? And I remember I was parked in a parking lot getting ready to, you know, drive off when they called. So I just like was sitting there in my car and I told them two of the stories and they said, okay, yeah, write about that. And
So what are we going to get a glimpse of in this chapter?
Oh my God. I mean, you know, to put it succinctly, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But, like on steroids, like with roid rage.
Well, that's why I thought it was a very unusual choice when the Go-Go's music was licensed or turned into a Broadway musical. Originally in 2015 and currently was running on Broadway in 2018, is that instead of sort of showcasing the LA punk scene of the 80s, that the plot takes place in a mythical sort of royal land of Arcadia.
And I didn't see that. I only saw clips of it, but I thought that was I sort of couldn't wrap my head around that.
Yeah, and so, you know, in contrast to, like, the musical Taboo that Boy George was involved in and you know, sort of following the accounts of the lives of
Lee Bowery,
was that it actually was trying to give us a glimpse into what those people's lives were like. And to me, I feel like as wonderful as the Head Over Heels may be as a musical, it really misses a golden opportunity to sort of, you know, tell your girls a story to a mainstream audience. So I'm hoping that this, you know, documentary that's coming out at Sundance and then it's going to be on Showtime is going to sort of, you know, bring to life this really beautiful scene that existed for a brief moment in time.
I can pretty much, like, just through my interview and talking to the director, Imhar O'Neill, you know, like we hung around after my interview and talked for a long time, I'm sure this is going to be an incredible documentary. I mean, I think it's just going to be amazing, and I think everybody that was in it is probably going to be no holds barred. So,
because part of it is like the appeal of Bohemian Rhapsody is a lot of the film actually just reenacts these famous moments in Queen and Freddie Mercury's lives. And, you know, even that Live Aid concert, we pretty much see the entire concert playing out, recreated before our eyes with CGI in the film. And I'm wondering, like, you know, that somebody would do very well to sort of bring to life some of these really beautiful moments in the Go-Go and the LA punks scene.
Yeah, I think it's going to be like that. I really do.
Is there a working title for the documentary, or haven't announced that yet?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's just, I don't know. Like, I just haven't.
They can't call it head over heels. And they can't call it your lips aren't sealed.
Maybe they should call it that.
Vacation? No.
Well, because when Lips Are Sealed was came out, I remember very clearly that everybody was like, oh my God, what a risque title, you know, because it was a reference to the labial lips, you know.
I don't think a lot of people got that, though.
Believe me, the people that were supposed to get it got it.
Well, I went to a Catholic school, so the joke was like, how are the Go-Go's like nuns?
How?
Their lips are sealed.
Oh my God. Don't get me started on nun jokes.
Oh, do you have some?
You want to hear? Here, I'll tell you one.
Okay.
So these two nuns were out on their bicycles on a very beautiful sunny afternoon. And wait, I hope I'm getting this right. Yeah, they were driving around. One of them said, oh, Sister Teresa, this road is very rough. And she said, oh, no, isn't it delightful?
You got to get it where you can.
Well, that's why I'm so excited about, like, the, you know, in Illinois, and not to get political here, but it's like they're already passed to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And the consequence of this is that it allows young people to have a better life. It allows youth culture to blossom. It allows for new ideas, to scenes to flourish. And so, you know, we can look forward, if this is successful, if we're able to kick Trump out of office and, you know, take our nation back from the Republicans, to have a better world for everybody, where everybody gets to shine, everybody gets to be happy and not be worried about whether they got cast on RuPaul's Drag Race or not. Just be fun, be you, be free.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Be anybody you want to be, baby. I think I'm quoting a movie there, but I'm not sure. what can you say to young people who, you know, what was the difficult aspects of your lives at that time? There must have been some uncertainty besides those screaming kids at 7 a.m. when you're trying to sleep. In Disgraceland. What was the uncertainty? What was the difficult aspect of your life at that time?
Well, the two aspects that were difficult, one has been sort of resolved, and the other one has been resolved for some. Of course, in those days, we were always worried about money, because in those days, even if you wore like all black clothes, which is just so normal now, or had colored hair, and I'm not even talking about purple or green, I mean like bleached white or like Lucille Ball red, or just, you know, like Liz Taylor black, people thought you were crazy in those days, you know? Like, so you couldn't get a job. You really couldn't. And nowadays you could sue for discrimination over that. Like, but like we couldn't get normal jobs. So there was always like the struggle of doing what we were doing, because most of us were artists. And by artists, I mean anything from like musicians, writers, performers, or all of the above, you know. So it was hard to live. Everyone was living communally. And it wasn't because we didn't have a work ethic. It was just hard to get hired at places, you know, and no one wanted to compromise the way they looked. And even if we did, like I tried, and people would still like think I was a witch or a punk rock lunatic.
But you are a witch.
I know. But, you know, if you're trying to get a job at a corporate place, I mean, I used to steal my mom's clothes to go into work, but they could still tell I was insane, even if I had my hair in a bun, you know?
what do people not understand about witchcraft? Because they're all like, well, if you're a witch, why don't you just cast a spell and get that job?
Yeah, well, I mean, stuff like that does happen, you know?
Why not get rid of Trump? Like, why, if you're a witch, you know, there's obviously limitations to your powers.
Well, you know that there's been like thousands or millions of witches hexing Trump since before the election.
Are they successful?
I mean, here's the thing that people don't understand about magic is it doesn't happen like, it's not like on Bewitched where it happens immediately.
And who knows, maybe like he could be a lot worse. Maybe they're binding him with love.
Yeah, some of them might be, yeah, mm-hmm. but I'm pretty sure a lot of them aren't.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, if someone did a spell at the height of the disco era and said, I want the gay community and the lesbian community and transgender people to come together and understand each other.
I think they
and
did
support
that
each other.
Well.
And so the prayer well. Worked, but you know, when it comes to spells and prayers, we have unintended consequences, the monkey's paw. And so the height of the AIDS crisis came along and forced our communities to come together in an unprecedented way. And through death, pain, and sacrifice, we were able to be stronger. But, and so, you know, so sometimes be careful what you wish for is the thing, right? It's like, you want to get Trump out of office, but, you know, is that mean bringing, you know, the next Hitler along? You know, it's like, sometimes it's really important when we're talking about, you know, manifesting desire.
You have to be very specific. You have to be super specific. That's the other thing. And you know what? Speaking of AIDS, yeah. I'm sorry, but I just can't believe that Rami Malek didn't mention anything about AIDS or any of that at the Oscars last night.
Well, he said, "I with the AIDS of the really good paycheck that I'll be receiving, I'll have a fabulous house and a great party afterwards."
Well, live AIDS.
Some people are mad though because he said that Freddie Mercury was gay, and some people are saying it's a bi erasure because he did have a relationship with a woman. But then other people are just saying, "Listen, he had one relationship with one woman. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's bisexual." You know, he could be gay. I guess, did he ever come out as anything?
I don't know, but, yeah. You know, that was different times again. No mm-hmm. one was coming out, or very few people were, you know, especially, like, of his stature, you know, mm-hmm. because Queen got so huge. But, mm-hmm. I mean, hello, the name Queen. That wasn't a reference to Elizabeth. I mean, we all know that.
Mm. Well, in interviews leading up to press for the Bohemian Rhapsody, the group, you know, like drummer Roger Taylor and other members were saying that they never really talked about Freddie Mercury's sexuality. And even in the film, when they're sort of like Freddie Mercury comes out as HIV positive to his bandmates. Mm-hmm. That actually happened, I believe, after the Live Aid, not beforehand.
Years later. Well, and also, too, I remember reading an article talking one of the bandmates saying that, yeah, you know, when AIDS first hit the scene, we talked to Freddie and we're like, hey, you know, you're going to change your behavior at all because of this. And Freddie is like, hell no. I'm going to keep on doing what I'm doing.
No compromises. I mean,
you know, also when Queen first started in like 1972 or 1973, it was, you know, that was at the height of glitter rock. And mm-hmm. that was when everyone, at least in rock and roll, was coming out as bisexual, you know, and that a lot of that wasn't, you know, that wasn't like to gain followers in mm-hmm. any way. You know,
well, and androgyny really—that's when it kind of first started to kind of take hold with, you know, David yeah. Bowie, and then you know, Elton John. They had those kind of
yeah,
androgynous
and Lou
looks.
Reed and all yeah. of it. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, that was that, and all of that scene was really getting its life from Max's Kansas City, the back mm-hmm. room there, which was populated with, like, you know, Candy Darling and Jackie Curtis and
Debbie Harry and
yeah, all the Warhol superstars mm-hmm. and just, like, you know, the other people that were around that whole underground New York
it's
scene.
Okay. You can call them freaks.
What? My people. You are yeah. talking about my people.
Of course
people.
We are. You know?
Freak with a capital F, yeah. darling.
Yeah.
It's a political statement. But the term that a lot of, I remember people using is gender fuck. And
yeah,
then that got co-opted into gender punk.
But it was first all androgyny. Everything yeah. androgyny this, androgyny that.
Jane County was the one that was like gender fuck. Jane County mm-hmm. was yeah. amazing.
Mm-hmm. And part, Jane County like toggles on and off. She feels like John Cameron Mitchell stole her life story with Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Last time we talked to her on the podcast, she said she was, okay with it.
She's okay with it, but it does feel like it's a kind of a ripoff of her life. But she's like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, what are you going to do? I know, really. Yeah. You can't do anything, but that was true.
Mm. Well, that's the thing. It's like for a lot of people, like the guy who wrote that song, Baby Shark.
Oh, my God. Now it's in my head.
He's suing the Korean company that put it on the, you know, they redid his song and put it on the internet. And I'm like, what do you think? And they made millions of dollars off the song. And he's, of course, suing them for a cut of the profits, you know.
Why wouldn't it's his song, right?
It's his song, you know. And they're all like, oh, well, this is a folk song that we have in Korea. I'm like, that's a lot of bullshit, but whatever, you know. And so the thing about it is that in terms of copyright in, you know, in the West, we have one idea of what that means. But in a lot of other cultures, we think of culture as something that's built upon itself. And so, you know, it's very acceptable for somebody to take a song, redo it, and put it out there to be purchased, and that artist then can take their version of the song and redo it again, and so on and so forth. So culture becomes very static in some ways, because people are not able to capitalize fully on their inventions and ideas. And so, you know, it's part of the reason why in the West we're always developing new movies and films, and we've started now getting very derivative because of the Asian market is putting so much demand on film studios to deliver the same goods over and over again. And so if you feel like you're, and you go to the movies, that the, especially these action hero adventure movies are very repetitive, or you've seen it before, is because of the Eastern way of looking at culture is about building upon itself.
And yeah, so, well, I mean, yeah. Just this morning, excuse me. Just this morning, I was thinking of the new Mary Poppins when I was in the shower. Yeah. I have no idea why. I haven't seen it, but I was like, why the hell would you remake that? That was like so perfect.
Well, it was amazing.
It was practically perfect in every way.
Well,
sure
it
was.
It was a sequel, so it was the little kids grown up and they needed their nanny again.
Well, the thing about that, if you really want to see the real sequel to Mary Poppins, don't go see the movie. See if you can catch the Broadway production that expanded the Mary Poppins verse to show the evil Mary Poppins. So in the because there are about like 15 books that P.L. Travers wrote about the character Mary Poppins.
Yeah, it's like the Oz books. There was like a million of them.
And so she, in one book, she's not getting along with the family, and the family's not listening to her, just like in The Simpsons where they did the Mary Poppins parody, and she leaves. And in her place comes this evil, like Trump, this evil Mary Poppins character that makes their lives miserable.
Was her name Scary Poppins?
Yeah. That's a good drag name.
And kind of like, you know, politically in this country, we had Obama, and we're sort of like, maybe we didn't appreciate him as much as we should have as a president, and now we have sort of the evil Mary Poppins in charge.
Oh my God, I wish he would just get on his umbrella and go away.
Well, I hope there's a hole in that umbrella that doesn't come back.
Or, yeah, maybe he's one of the people on that Umbrella Academy show on Netflix.
Oh, I really enjoyed that show.
And so, you know, in terms of the Mary Poppins, it's like, you know, go check out. There are some good alternate versions or new versions of that story that don't feel derivative and don't feel like they're sort of rewriting the charm of the original film.
Okay, well, now that we're talking about being in the air somehow, can I just, like, put this out to the universe?
Yeah.
I'm going to be 60 on March 17th.
Yay!
Congratulations, love.
On March 17th?
Yeah, on St. Patrick's Day.
All right. Are you going to wear green?
Like, I haven't done it for 59 other birthdays. No. but I think it's time to fulfill one of the, you know, top spots on my bucket list. And that's, I need to ride in the Goodyear blimp. I mean, I need to ride in a blimp. And I have to tell you what happened on Twitter like a year or two ago. This is so sad. And I haven't called them out on it because I'm trying to be nice and, you know, curry their favor so I can really get on the blimp. But Goodyear had a contest a few years ago on Twitter and said, if you retweet, you know, this tweet, you could be entered to get a ride in the blimp. So I retweeted it so many times, I had to go to the chiropractor for like trigger finger. But I added the hashtag blimpin' ain't easy. and they stole it from me and I didn't win.
Oh, curses.
They're evil.
Are you still going to try and get on there for
the humanity?
Yes. No, I'm trying to get on it. I've already on Facebook, my banner photo has a blimp. I think it might have been the Hindenburg floating over floating over the pyramids in Giza, like in a picture from the 20s. And then I started an Instagram campaign. I mean, not an ad, but I'm just like yesterday I saw the blimp during the Oscars. It flew right over my house and I took that as a really good omen. But I'm just, I have to go on the blimp. So
you have to get on that.
What's the appeal of riding in the Goodyear blimp as opposed to like an airplane or a hot air balloon?
You know what? I have no idea. I've just wanted to do it since I was little. I think because it looks like such a big, dumb, slow baby shark, like floating through the air. I don't know. It's so amazing.
There's an appeal to it.
Well, in the film Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, him and Indiana Jones and his father ride the Hindenburg.
The Hindenburg. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you want to know the Hindenburg? This is like, you know how the newscasters said, oh, the humanity, you know, when it was crashing and burning ever since the 80s, I used to use that. I'd wake up first thing in the morning after like, you know, a binge of partying and I'd go, oh, the humanity. But now, one of my stock lines, I mean, I still do burlesque. I still dance all the time, but people are like, wow, you look amazing for your age. And I'm like, thank you. But I have been known to say my boobs used to be the Hindenburg, but now they're, the humanity.
Well, I heard that like riding those hot air balloons at the height of its luxury was very actually wonderful. They were very quiet and you can open up the windows and look out into the world. And it was very glamorous and they had wonderful food and alcohol.
Yeah, you had to dress up to get on it.
Yeah, it was like being this wonderful, luxurious lounge for a couple of hours and you got to your destination.
And it just never really caught on. I think that the Hindenburg exploding was just enough for people to be like, I'll try a plane.
But actually, lighter than air travel is actually a very ecological way to travel because of the fact that the helium gas does a lot of the heavy lifting, literally, and allows the cargo and the passengers to be transported in a very efficient way.
Helium's always a good thing.
But I guess we only have a fixed amount on the Earth. And once it's gone, it's gone. Mm. So they have to go back to hydrogen gas, which was the Hindenburg. And just make sure it doesn't blow up this time.
I know, like hydrogen bombs. I mean, hydrogen is like hydrogen and helium are like the polar opposites, like energetically of each other.
Well, you're a witch and you understand physics, the exchange of energy.
Yes. The polarization, the duality, all of it. Yes.
And so with a burlesque show that you do called Bell, Book and Candle.
Yes.
You guys are all Wiccans or witches and perform by embracing your bodies no matter what shape condition they're in and embrace the sexuality and the beauty of your body by teasing, taking your clothes off for the audience.
Yes, and it's all that Bell Book and Candle is all occult themed or dark fairy tales or goth or witchy. And it's a wild show. It's like I tweeted last night. I was like, if there was Oscars for occult burlesque, we'd win. But that show came about in such a crazy way. I mean, it all came about through a bunch of synchronicities, and it's like when we started doing it, I had a dream that I had a show called Bell, Book, and Candle, and it was a reference to the Kim Novak movie from the 50s where she was a beatnik sorceress in Greenwich Village, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then everything just came together with my co-producer, Shauna. And then I hadn't been in L.A. for so long because I was traveling all over the place, you know, to teach dance. And I kept thinking I should have it at El Cid, which is like this really awesome classic venue that, you know, it used to be a soundstage in the 20s and the 30s. And then in the 30s and the 40s, it was called the Jail Cafe. And all the waiters would wear like striped jail outfits and serve movie stars on tin cups, you know. And then So I kept wanting it to be at El Cid because it had so much Hollywood history, but I kept thinking I need to look at other clubs. So I was looking at clubs and I couldn't find anywhere that would have like a great raised stage with beautiful lights, but also have a quiet place for the psychics that we have to read. And one day I woke up like with it in my head, call Lena Licaro, call Lena Licaro. And Lena is like, for years, she's been like the head of Hopper or Luella Parsons of LA. And she's now the LA Weekly culture editor, but she's also a DJ. So it was screaming in my head to call her because I thought she would have a good idea of where I should put the show on. So I described the concept of the show to her. And then she said, oh, wow, that sounds fantastic. Where were you thinking of doing it? And I said, I keep coming back to one place, El Cid. And the phone went completely quiet. And then I was like, do you not think that's a good idea? And she said, did anyone tell you I started booking it last night? And I was like, no. And so she gave me a date in, you know, that was 2 weeks out from that. So I said, I'll take it, but only if I can get every third Wednesday, because that's what day it was, all summer, because I think this show will grow. And so she checked and she said, yes. So we got the first show together in 2 weeks and it sold out. And then it continued selling out, and it's almost 2 years old now. But the weirdest thing about this whole thing, because it's a witch burlesque show, is that it's every time it's either on the dark moon, the full moon, and it hits each one of the equinoxes. Like the next one is March 20th in Los Angeles at El Cid. And it's not only the exact day of spring equinox, and it's my birthday show, but it's also the full moon. It's the full corn moon, which is the first moon of spring. So
that's pretty freaky.
No, it's really freaky. And then we always have someone that's like a really well-known like magical practitioner do a ritual in the show. So this is a really funny story. And the rituals are not, you know, they're not, if you or the audience isn't familiar with the rituals, a lot of these are very, you know, they're made theatrical, so the audience that might not have anything to do with magic can enjoy it as an experience too, you know. But so we were having a ritual one time, and a friend of mine was standing at the bar, and this waiter came rushing up with a tray full of empty drinks, and he set them down on the bar with a big clatter, and he goes, you know, I haven't had a day off in 9 days, and now they're fucking summoning Satan in there. which wasn't what was happening, but it was like the best overheard thing.
Well, it's witchcraft is often misunderstood, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's so trendy right now. It's really trendy.
Mm.
Yeah, with Sabrina, the teenage witch on Netflix.
Yes, and they're writing about it in Vogue, and there's like all the a friend of mine who's a witch, Gabby Herstick, she has a column about witchcraft in the Weed magazine called High Times, and her column is called High Priestess.
Oh my god, I love it.
Does anyone ever ask you, are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Yeah, people say that all the time.
I was like, aren't they all good witches?
Yeah, some of them are good witches, but some of them could be bad witches, just like anybody. I mean,
well, whilst you also can be a desire to do good, but not be good at it.
That's exactly true. Yes, that happens.
I'm a good person, but I'm a bad witch.
I just suck at being a witch. You know, I tried, but I just, you know, that monkey's paw keeps taking as it gives.
I'll tell you something really funny. One of the things, this is why I had to say the Goodyear blimp, because this has to do with witchcraft, because I'm manifesting it by saying it, putting it out on the podcast and on social media, because hashtag blimping ain't easy. But on New Year's Day, I manifested something so crazy. So I was in a car coming from a brunch with this wonderful foxy gay boy witch, and we drove past one of those, like, you know, storefront psychics, and I pointed to the sign and I said, I need to get one of those. I've wanted one of those since I was 12 or 13. And then And then he said, our friend Marcella, her name is Marcella Krall, and she's an amazing witch. Yeah, and she has a beautiful oracle deck called the Sacred Symbols Oracle out that's just magical. But so he said, our friend Marcella just got one. And I was like, what? And I had to pull over. I was so like just in awe, but also really envious. And I was pounding on the steering wheel going, okay, that does it. This is my New Year's resolution of 2019. I'm getting a damn psychic sign. The next morning, I woke up to a series of like texts dinging on my phone, and it was way too early. And I was like, what the hell is going on? And so I looked at it, and the first text had this picture of a psychic sign, like a really cheesy, awesome, old school psychic sign, you know, with like a hand and a crystal ball and cards.
The eyeball and stuff.
Yeah. And then there was another one. And then there was a picture of a big sign with a bunch of small signs and a sandwich board. And this was a message from one of the boys I had turned into a drag queen 25 years previously, you know, and we were still in touch. And, he said, do you want these? Can you use these? And I was so uncaffeinated. The only thing I texted back was like about 4 inches of exclamation points. And then when I had coffee, I was like, yeah, where? I want it. I want it. Where is it? How much is it? Just let me know if I can pick it up. And he said, no, I found these in the garbage. I'm giving them to you. And he showed up at the store where I do tarot readings, the Green Man store, with this giant like 5x5 psychic sign in the back of a pickup truck, and he brought like a screw gun, you know, like a drill screw thingy. That sounded wrong, but you know what I mean. And so he put it up in my room, and I was like literally hopping around like a toddler singing Baby Shark. I couldn't believe that I had this sign and that I manifested it. And then he said he had to go, and he left, and I was sitting there, and all of a sudden I got all forlorn, and I was like, why can't I do this with the lottery?
The blimp,
money does not solve your problems, but it allows a new lifestyle to flourish. Because what is it? You can win the lottery, but in order to change your life, you have to lift all ships. And the lottery is only concentrating power and energy in one person.
Or
and
lift
it's not
the
distributing it in your community.
Well, I would distribute it in my community. I can tell you that right now, but... I think it's not a permanent solution.
So that's why we got to raise the minimum wage, honey. $15 an hour. Everybody wins. There's more money for goods and services. The economy does better. Businesses do better. Everybody except the Trump does better.
train young people to be blimp pilots.
I believe in the future world with blimps.
I believe in a very near future with blimps. I'm just saying that right now.
Yeah. Pleasant, it's so delightful to talk to the Queen of Hollywood once again.
It was awesome to talk to the Queens of Chicago once again.
Oh, I appreciate that.
So for folks, they want to check you out. They can follow you as the Queen of Hollywood on Twitter.
No, it's Princess
of Hollywood.
Because there's already enough Queens in Hollywood. On Instagram, it's Princess of Hollywood. And it's also Belle Book and Candle, B-E-L-L-E underscore book underscore candle underscore. On Twitter, I'm Pleasant Gehman, PleasantGehman1. And I'm also Princess Farhana and The Divination Nation. So I have 3 Twitter accounts. On Facebook, I'm Pleasant Gehman. Don't send me a friend request. I know I'm going to sound cunty, but there's like 600 friend requests I haven't looked at. But if you comment on something I write, I'll friend you. And yeah, that's I'm all over the social medias.
Her Royal Highness, the Princess of Hollywood, Princess Farhana, the Divination, Pleasant Gehman.
Thank you, Pleasant. It's always a pleasure. And come back soon. Don't wait so long. I always love talking
with you. Thank
you,
dolls. It was awesome.
Uh-huh.
Hearts of kisses.
Bye.
Bye.
Pleasant Gay Man lives in Los Angeles, California. All this fabulous, what is it? More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of LA Punk by John Doe and Tom DeSavia hits bookstores June 4th in 2019, later this summer. And of course, the documentary of the Go-Go's, which is still being edited as we speak, will hit Sundance first and then Showtime later this year.
So. So you get to see Pleasant talk about her relationship with the Go-Go's.
Well, I feel like, you know, there's an appetite for looking back at our culture and youth culture and music. And certainly, you know, the LA punk scene is one of those moments in time that were really magical and wonderful and inspired so many people around the world to live their best life, fearlessly be themselves, and decorate.
I want to thank everybody for listening, and I want to tell you we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus. And right now we have our computer is on the fritz, and we've got to get a new one. So we have a GoFundMe up, and you can donate to that cause at gofundme.com/feastoffuncomputer.
Do you like the show? Do you like the interesting people we talk to? We are only here because of your financial support. Mm-hmm. We are made possible because of fabulous people like you. If you've been thinking about jumping in and becoming a member at our membership site and access all kinds of goodies, get to watch Cooking with Drag Queens episodes before everyone else gets to see them, we're going to be making that possible at feastoffun.com/plus. Thank you so much for being a part of our lives, Princess Farhana, The Divination, Pleasant Gay Man.
And thanks again to Jeff Knutson for setting this all up. Well, we wouldn't be able to do it without you, Jeff. Thank you.
The show is produced by Jeff Knutson. Mm-hmm. Remember it by name. Bye, bye, everyone. Bye.